This is file 96. This is Jean McMillan. I am interviewing Jeffrey Brown. He is going to tell me quite a lot about the Trinity Church and the Lime Rock Cemetery. Today's date is June 4th, 2015, and we'll start with the genealogical information. Mr. Brown, what is your name?
My name is Jeffrey Brown. No middle name.
And your birth date?
I was born July 18th, 1941, in Liberty, New York.
Where is Liberty, New York?
Liberty, New York is in Sullivan County, about 100 miles due west of here, and its principal claim to fame, I guess, is that it was one of the three hubs of what's become known as the Borscht Circuit.
I've been in Sullivan County.
The Catskills, as
yes.
they say.
And your parents' names?
My father was Edmund Brooke Brown from Washington, Indiana, and my mother was Helen May Cross of Liberty.
Did you have siblings?
No, I was an only one.
We're special.
Yeah.
Your educational background after high school?
Okay, I got my bachelor's in American history at Hamilton College in Clinton, New York, and then went on and got an MBA in industrial relations and human behavioral systems at Columbia. Then the Army got hold of me and taught me about computers.
Good!
And somewhere along the line, I got an advanced professional certificate in finance from NYU, and the last formal experience educationally after that was after I retired from Citibank and came up here and took a whole bunch of courses at Northwest Connecticut Community College.
A wonderful educational institution.
Absolutely right. I can't say enough good about it. I really think it's absolutely first rate.
And I know that you came to this area originally as a summer rental person.
Yes, ma'am.
And you are now a permanent resident.
Yep.
Wonderful.
Many of us do that, actually. I was working at Citibank, and the fellow with whom I shared an office asked me if me and my then-girlfriend would like to take a share in a summer house. And I was thinking, oh my God, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars for something on Long Island, in the Hamptons. And I said, well, Peter, how much would that be? And he said, $250. And I said, what's that, for a weekend? And he said, no, that's for the whole season. And I said, how long is the season, a month? And he said, no, from 2 weeks before Labor Day, to Memorial Day, to 2 weeks after Labor Day. And I said, sold, without even knowing where it was.
Ah, it was an adventure.
It certainly was. The first time we saw the place was that the night that we got a ride up with another couple and came zipping into the driveway. And it was on Twin Lakes.
What year was that, roughly?
That was probably 1974 or 5.
And when did you buy property here?
We finally bought in 1980.
And did you build a house or?
No, we bought a house that had been on the market for a long time. Nobody much cared about Twin Lakes property in those days.
Oh, yeah.
And it had been hanging out there for years. The price hadn't moved. And it was 3.5 acres with a separate parcel with 40 feet of lakefront.
And it was just waiting for you and your wife.
It was waiting for me. We came in and we said,
this is it.
Why not?
Wonderful. Wonderful. I'm going to start with the Lime Rock Cemetery.
Okay.
And I'd like you to tell me what you can about the early part of the cemetery. When did it come into being, if you know, where it's located, and why it was formed?
The earliest part of the Lime Rock Cemetery isn't on the site of the current cemetery. It wasn't on the site of the current cemetery. As far as I've been able to find out, it's been there about as long as people have lived in Lime Rock, or, you know, Europeans have lived in Lime Rock, which probably takes us back to the fairly early 1700s, and probably involves people people who happened to die there and were buried in Lime Rock Hollow, which can be defined, depending on who you talk to, as either of two rather distinct locales, either down what's now called Lime Rock Hollow Road or up toward Camp's Forge, up toward...
Then which one...
I theorize, and this is only theory,
okay,
that it was the latter, that it was up the Salmon Kill, and that removal, that cemetery ultimately was moved to the current cemetery.
You're getting ahead of me.
Okay. Okay.
To clarify, where you're talking about is...
The original Lime Rock
Cemetery. The original Lime Rock Cemetery, which is around where John Fitch lived, which was 433 Salmon Kill Road.
Somewhere in that area.
Somewhere in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a historical sign that talks about Lamb's Forge in that general area.
Yeah.
This is what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's okay. Exactly right.
All right. The part of the cemetery that I know is on 112.
That's right, and that's the only part that's left.
That's the only part that's left. And tell
that
me
was
about
subsequent. That was subsequent to, that was certainly far subsequent to the creation of that early cemetery. When the cemetery on 112 and Dugway was carved out,
mm-hmm.
My understanding is that that was Goodwin family property.
Yes.
And Ence and Goodwin, they're all kind of mixed up in there.
Oh, yeah.
I know the Ensigns gave the land for Trinity originally, and my understanding was that the Goodwins owned the other side of the road, but mm-hmm. they were pretty heavily intermarried, so
yep.
Who knows who actually owned it. And I'm theorizing, and I don't know, and I haven't been able to find out when that cemetery was actually set up. It was before Trinity was built. Starting in 1873.
The date that I have is 1858.
That sounds reasonable.
Good.
That sounds perfectly reasonable. The way the cemetery, the current Lime Rock Cemetery was set up in that corner of Dugway and 112, clearly reflected the importance of the Barnums and Richardsons at that point in time, with that fine lawn in the corner,
yep.
And then a row, and then the head row,
mm-hmm.
which included Barnum and Richardson and
yes.
two other families, both of which escape my mind at the moment. One of whom was a doctor and who may have been married at some way into the Barnum family, but I mm-hmm. that's only. Something I've heard, not something I can confirm. And then a few more secondary luminaries.
Yes.
And then a large plot for removals from the old Lime Rock Cemetery, the original one, was left blank. And left blank on the cemetery maps. And then behind that came ordinary people. And then in the very back was a row of... very poor people.
Mm-hmm. At Potter's Field.
Yeah. Let's see.
The early part that you
yep.
mentioned with the Barnums and the Richardsons, and they had lovely big obelisks.
Yes. Yes.
That's the part that's being restored right now.
Good.
We have 16 stones that are in the process of being restored.
Good.
And we've chosen the ones that were in the most need.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to point that out.
Okay, no, that's fine.
When the removals were done, was it by state mandate or was it just to coordinate everybody into one spot?
I have a feeling it was done because Barnum and Richardson wanted to raise the level of the mill pond.
Mm-hmm.
And the best... I mean, Lime Rock was pretty much a company town
oh, yeah.
at that point, and
oh,
there
sure.
was no reason that they couldn't do that if they wanted to. And I doubt that cemeteries were very regulated by the state or anyone else.
Not that time.
And they did carve out And they did, when they laid out the new Lime Rock Cemetery, did carve out a good-sized chunk of land.
Yes.
For removals, which it tells me that they anticipated doing this.
Do you have a date for the removals?
I do not, but I do have the best information that I have on that, or the closest you can back into a date, is that Senator Barnum's father was presumably buried in that in the original cemetery, mm-hmm. because he lived right close
right
by there.
Right there, sure.
And he is now in, I don't know what they call it, a field engraving or whatever, his name appears on the back of the main Barnum tombstone. Obviously, it was not done in the workshop where the stone was made.
Right.
It was done probably in
hand
the field by
yeah.
some. Yeah. And which leads me, which dates the removal after his death, and well, it's hard to say. That's about all it really does, because ostensibly the Barnum stone was already up by the time the removals took place.
The date that I have is 1882.
That sounds reasonable.
Okay.
That sounds fine.
You know, this is all
yeah.
approximate. The other information that I have about the first burial was John Knickerbocker.
Well, it's the oldest stone that you can read in the current Lime Rock Cemetery.
And that was one of the five Dutch families that lived in this area.
Yeah, and it was spelled Knickerbocker.
Oh, yes, it was.
Fascinating.
The death date was November 10th, 1786, and he was age 76 at that time.
Sounds good. And that was pretty clearly a removal.
That would have been a removal. So the early cemetery probably goes back before 1800.
Oh, it certainly does. I would say well before 1800. Mm-hmm. I looked at the, I just happened, and I don't remember what the starting date was, but the little plaque that I guess the Lime Rock Women's Club or Garden Club or put on that
gristmill. Yes.
Says, to the early settlers.
Yep.
And that's
what they were.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Then you added in 1992 a columbarium.
Yes, in 1992 a columbarium was built, and it was a smart thing to do, I think.
Oh, yes.
First of all, there was space to do it. Secondly, I think, basically, burying bodies had become a little, you know, something for old people. Mm-hmm. I mean, something that only old people were very interested in.
It conserves space and it's more environmentally
safe. Absolutely, and cheaper and everything
mm-hmm.
else. It's, now I can't remember. I can't remember the last time at Trinity we've had a funeral with a body present.
Yeah, it's mostly
yeah.
cremations.
Yeah. But interestingly, I guess it was about 10, 12, 15 years ago, they were apparently having trouble getting people to take spaces in the columbarium.
Really?
So Jeff Silvernail,
bless his heart,
had an idea, and he said, Jeff, you take pictures? I can get Mike Root to bring over his bucket truck, and you can go up in the bucket and take pictures, and it will help people understand what the columbarium is like.
What a wonderful idea.
Well, it was a great idea, except I swear I'll never go up in the bucket again. I took it up as high as I dared go, and it's swaying back.
Oh, yeah.
And I am trying to take pictures of the columbarium and so forth. But, yeah, we did it.
Yes. I've been over to observe it. And how many spaces are there?
Oh, I don't know, but there are a lot of people in there now.
About 40, I think.
Probably. And it, yeah, no, I think.
It's a wonderful idea.
It is, and it's a nice setting.
It's a beautiful setting. I was there for Ann Roller's service.
Yes, yes.
And I understand there's going to be another memorial service coming up soon. because her plaque is going to be put on.
Oh, okay, that's good.
On the columbarium.
Oh, I know that her mom is coming up shortly, and I wonder if we.
I know Jeff Silvernail knows about it because I taped him on Monday.
Oh, okay. No, that's it's good. It's good. It's actually good to know that. I nominated Anne for the United States, the late Anne, regrettably, for the United States Pony Club Academy of Achievement, as a matter of fact. Based on her subsequent career in
wonderful
video, you know, in sports videoing for CNN, I guess. And, no, that was a very fine girl.
Yes, she was. I didn't know her very well. I worked with her mother here at the library.
Oh, Jane is
fabulous. Super. Absolutely fabulous. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to the cemetery portion?
Well, I guess I could add this. I have not been successful in tracking down a list of the removals.
That's going to be pretty difficult, I think.
And I've talked to two people. Well, Jeff Silvernail, of course, who said he didn't know of any. And Ginny Dildine, who I think for many years was the secretary of the
and she's a fabulous source.
Yeah, and she said she didn't know of any list. And if there is one, it may be simply that the records from the original Lime Rock Cemetery were not that hot.
That's entirely possible. The death certificates now do state where somebody's buried, but they may not have done it then, and our records would only go back to 1741.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask the assistant town clerk if she's got any records on the removals.
That would be great. It's, as I say, it's something I don't know, and actually one thing that we do at Trinity occasionally is have a little procession, go over to the cemetery, and put flowers on graves of people with some association with Trinity, like Barnum and Richardson. I'll start at the front and go all the way to the back, and usually by the time we get to the back, we've lost most of the procession because they've gotten tired.
Yeah, that happens.
We usually have the kids do the flower placing, and they get a little bit bored after a while. So it doesn't.
If you put a Tootsie Roll behind each grave,
maybe even then, I think they'd get pretty sated, but they start out with their huge armfuls of flowers.
Oh, but that's such a lovely thing to do.
Oh, well, it's fun, and I think it's a suitable thing for Memorial Day. Well,
yes,
Memorial
it is.
Day, whatever.
Any day.
All Saints.
I'm trying to make sure that all of the veterans are honored with a standard and a flag, and it's a little dicey with the columbarium to know exactly where to put the standard and the flag.
Yeah, that's
true. We're working on that one. Then I'm going to switch to Trinity Church.
Okay, the last thing I really need to say about the cemetery is two things. It's always interesting to look at it and see it as it was when it was constructed, and that's why you see all the rings along the top of the wall for hitching horses.
Oh, yeah.
And I think at the very front end, at the front angle, why you have the step, which was a combination mounting block and on-foot entrance to the cemetery.
I know, I would automatically assume that everybody knew that, but you're absolutely right to include it.
There were some visitors at Trinity who I showed it to who were sort of, huh?
Had no clue.
Absolutely. Absolutely none. And presumably when Senator Barnum was buried, they carried him in the front.
Probably.
Rather than around the back.
Oh, well, he'd go in the front.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, Trinity Church.
Okay. Where do you want to start?
When was it built?
The cornerstone was laid in 1873.
And what is its style?
Well, the style is a it actually falls in a gradation between Gothic Revival and what's called Richardson Romanesque, and the Richardson, mm-hmm. it's named after as an architect in Boston, not Barnum, not Richardson as in Barnum and Richardson. It's a little bit, it doesn't really pass muster as either.
It's sort of a...
It's a little...
A composite.
It's a composite, it's a transitional style,
mm-hmm.
and the architect who did it, and I write this one down to make sure I get it absolutely right, it was Henry Martin Congdon, and Martin is spelled M-A-R-T-Y-N. There's a...
Again, the name, please?
Henry Martin Congdon, C-O-N-G-D-O-N.
C-O-N-D-G-O-N.
C-O-N-G-D-O-N.
C-O-N...
G-D-O-N.
Henry. Okay. Because I had Richard Upjohn.
Well,
that's an inaccuracy.
That is absolutely incorrect.
That's why I wanted to be sure that you had the right name.
I have, yes. This, and I can tell you how I know. The parish, the original parish register, parish registers in the old days used to be set up, you know, it's a blank book,
mm-hmm.
with a section for a parish history.
Mm-hmm.
And the first rector, in his own hand, recorded the parish history as he understood it. And he obviously did not, since he was not around there, ever meet or ever know Mr. Congdon. So he wrote, the architect, Mr. Blank Congdon, and went on.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I became suspicious originally that it was not an Upjohn church.
Yeah.
First of all, because it doesn't look the least bit like an Upjohn church. Mm-hmm. If you struggle, you can say, well, the hammer beams inside look a little bit like the inside of St. Mary's, one of Congdon's earliest churches in New Jersey that's burned down
yeah.
since. But really, it's flattened more than it would be if it were a Congdon church. The chancel is way too wide for Congdon. He did not do wide chancels. He did only narrow...
Single cell. Yeah.
The buttresses are wrong. The tower is wrong. The curved lines in the where lines are curved where they should be straight.
Uh-huh.
It just doesn't look the it really it you know.
It's just not
it could
enough
be,
John
could
Church.
Be frankly, yeah. It's not enough John Church. It could be as much a Frank Lloyd Wright church as it could be an Upjohn Church, as far as I'm concerned.
All right.
Now the kind of figure also was able to say where the mistake appeared. There was a period of time in the bad old days of Trinity, after Barnum and Richardson failed,
mm-hmm.
and Trinity almost did, when they shared a rector with Christ Church Canaan. As a matter of fact, they shared not just a rector, but they shared a Ford car for the rector to go back and forth in. The rector, bless his heart, did go back and forth, and it said that he liked the bottle a bit much.
Yeah, it seems to be.
And it does. It's an affliction of clergy, unfortunately.
Episcopal and Anglican is both.
Absolutely. And he occasionally had a tendency to confuse his two charges. He recorded in the parish register in Canaan, events that took place in Trinity, and vice versa. And because it is an Upjohn church in Canaan, it became, if he used the same sermon in both churches and referred to the architect as Upjohn, and since Upjohn had a bit more social cachet than Congdon, you can see that people eager to grasp some social cachet might decide that Trinity must be the Upjohn Church in question.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I went a little further with this. My wife went through the Connecticut Western News in when the original copies were still in Falls Village. And she found a reference to Congdon being the architect there. And I've not seen that article, but I trust her her memory on that. And then I went a little further, and I was in New York City, and the Upjohn archives, or most of them, are at the New York Public Library. So I did a fast search there for Lime Rock, Lakeville, Trinity, other than Trinity Wall Street, of course, which was an Upjohn church, and came up blank. And Barnum, who was the guy who would have written the check, no, absolutely blank. Absolutely blank. No, just a big hole as far as the
was
Upjohn.
Was this Mr. Condon from New York City?
He was originally, I think, from, I should know this. I know that
his business.
Was a junior partner of a guy who was as seminal as Upjohn in the Gothic revival named Priest. And he ultimately took over Priest's architectural practice.
Was that a New York City
practice?
That
was a New York City practice. That was right down there as a matter of fact, it was in the same building as Barnum and Richardson's New York headquarters. On 2 Broadway or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I went further. I found Congdon's granddaughter, who was a history professor, and I'm blanking on where, I think somewhere in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Who had decided to recreate or reconstruct what Congdon did, and she'd done an amazing job of it.
Uh-huh.
And she said, "Well, yes,
of course,
Trinity Lime Rock."
All right.
And you know, he also did the baptismal font in Sharon.
Oh, good.
Which nobody seems to know.
Well, we do now.
Yeah,
you've been recorded.
But so this is, and then it was well documented that Congdon did this church, did Trinity Torrington. About 10 years later.
Now, I would like to know why Trinity was built. They could go to St. John's.
Well,
this is going to lead into a good story, I know.
Several.
Good.
Actually, the real reason Trinity was built, I think. Well, now I'll even back up further from that. Senator Barnum was a politically was highly partisan.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Democrat in an age when Republicans were largely on the ascendancy, in the tradition of, you know, the Republicans came out as the good guys from the Civil War, and the Democrats were very closely tied during that period to the Southerners and slavery and that sort of thing, and there was a good deal of animosity. I mean, it probably makes today's partisan animosity pale by comparison.
Yeah.
But it was pretty heated. And taking that as a starting point, my impression is that most of the vestry at St. John's Church, where ostensibly Barnum was a member, was Republican, and he was a Democrat. So that at that point in time could have created some antagonism. Barnum himself was probably not terribly religious. There was, and I tried to locate it the other day, and I couldn't find it, a piece of congressional biography that said that he had no religion. And I can't find it. I saw it, I remember it, it made a big impression on me, yeah, I can't find it. And it actually helped me understand why, after putting his name in the John Hancock position on the list of incorporators of Trinity, his name virtually disappears.
Yeah.
He never serves as a warden, never serves as a vestryman.
Did he fund it?
Yeah, he paid for it. He paid for the building. But he could, because he was the richest man in Northwest Connecticut at that point, by some margin, I think. But back to reasons that Trinity was found. First of all, if you were an Episcopalian in Trinity, you really had a choice of two places to go, St. John's in Salisbury or Christ Church in Canaan. Sharon. Christ Church in Sharon being the oldest Episcopal church around here, but also not an easy trek from Salisbury. Or from
Lime Rock, no.
Yeah. You got a mountain in the way.
Clarify. There's a Christ Church in Canaan.
And a Christ Church in Sharon. Yeah.
Okay. And now we're talking about the Sharon Church.
The Sharon Church, yeah.
Okay.
So the Barnums and Richardsons ostensibly went to the Christ Church, went to St. John's in Salisbury.
Mm-hmm.
There was, first of all, the possible political animosity.
Yeah.
There was the distance.
Yeah.
And the oft-told story of how Barnum, who, yes, did have, and Richardson's, they both had very fine horses, and they used to race them, and horse races in those days were not quite as, perhaps as orderly as they are now, but be that as it may. And that Barnum, and that they would race back from, they would race back after
Church.
Services. And Barnum usually won, but one muddy day he did not, and came back covered in mud and was not happy about it and said, "We need a church of our own." Probably a little verging on the apocryphal, but...
Well, that story was told by Judge Warner in his journal that he wrote in 1926.
Okay, so at least it has some...
It's got some merit to it.
Yeah.
Only in his story, it wasn't mud, it was dust. And he didn't like to eat dust.
Oh, okay. Well, eating dust was a good term then, so that's...
So we're good on that.
Where whatever substance it was, the roads weren't paved, so it came off the roads.
Oh, nice.
And in fact, I can think of the Richardsons were also big into fine horses, and he could well have lost to a Richardson. And then there are other stories. There's a story that Mrs. Barnum was not socially accepted by the ladies at St. John's.
It could be.
There was a story that Senator Barnum swore in church at St. John's, and that resulted in his ejection, which I doubt was true, because there was a certain amount of money there, and you really don't want to...
Well, possibly, but there is a story from Henry Kiera, who was rector of St. John's back in the 30s, and I guess one of the Scoville ladies was insistent on he do thus and such, and the story in the family is, "Madam, it is my church, and I will do it my way," and she left.
And, well, the Scovilles had a certain amount of money, too.
Yeah, so you never know.
That's absolutely true. Now, that's thoroughly believable. Anyway, I believe that probably there was a little bit of unpleasantness, regardless of how it manifested itself. There was mileage, and there was another thing which I think is really important here, and that is something that Mrs. Barnum allegedly said, and from what I've learned of Barnum, and Barnum principally in his family, is consistent. She said that the people here seem to be at loose ends religiously, and she was probably talking about the Barnum kids, the Richardson kids,
and the upper echelon.
The upper echelon, and they very likely were slightly at loose ends, that, you know, children of rich kids, of rich families, occasionally do tend to be, when most everybody
isn't.
In the lower echelons went to the little Methodist church in on Barnum's front lawn, mm-hmm. or trek to Lakeville or Falls Village mm-hmm. for one of the Catholic churches.
Yeah.
Or actually trek to Falls Village since Lakeville
came about later.
So she said they're a little loose end spiritually and that something ought to be done. And then, ostensibly, Barnum said we should have a church of our own.
Then it really wasn't founded for the benefit of the immigrant workers, because there weren't that many English.
No, there weren't. They were mostly
Catholic.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Barnum, interestingly, did subsidize both St. Mary's mm-hmm. pretty heavily.
Yep.
I think the New York Times said that he had contributed something like, I think the language is better than $6,000,
yeah,
which was a lot of money back in those days, toward a convent at St. Mary's.
Oh, yes.
He also had partially funded a Catholic church in Cornwall Bridge, which is still there. It's that cute little...
Oh, St. Bridget's?
Yeah.
I think it's St. Bridget's.
Yeah. He had been one of the major contributors to that. Significantly, there was, of course, a Barnum and Richardson furnace.
Oh, yes.
There. If you think about labor history of that period, mm-hmm. the enlightened entrepreneurs were beginning to catch on to the idea that if you took care of your workers and tried to kind of mold their worldview, mm-hmm. they were better workers. They didn't get drunk every opportunity and be worthless for a day or two afterward. They didn't raise hell. And churches were very good means of social control.
Oh yes. Oh yes, absolutely.
So Barnum could be not very religious at all and see great benefit in funding churches.
And I'm thinking we have three company towns. We had Amesville.
Sure.
We had Lime Rock.
Yeah.
And we had Furnace Village, Lakeville.
Sure.
And they were all company towns where houses were built for the workers.
Yes.
And there was, except for Amesville, there was a church.
Mm-hmm. There was a mission.
There was a mission.
The first rector at Trinity, as a matter of fact, mm-hmm. walked to Amesville to conduct services.
Yep. Yep. So that it has credence in the
very much so. But having company churches was every bit as consistent with industrial relations in that era as having a company band or a company baseball team.
And they had both.
They had the band and they had the baseball team. Right.
What are some of the uses of Trinity Church besides the religious ceremonies?
Oh, now?
Well, anything else that you can think of?
Oh, my God. Well, before my time, Trinity decided to start... Well... Trinity was involved in some small way that I haven't quite been able to determine in the Lime Rock Artists Association of the 1920s. I don't think they had anything in the way of gallery space at that point, mm-hmm. but there was a fair amount of cross-fertilization between the leading lights in the Artists Association and the vestry of Trinity. That's probably the first real venture in the community other than church-type mm-hmm. ventures mm-hmm. where you would see sad entries in the parish register about people who had been injured, and died, or poor girls who had been married in the rectory, which I think in those days meant that she was pretty pregnant.
Yeah, and we have to get her a husband quickly.
Yeah, but from there, I know that Trinity was the prime mover behind the Antiques Festival.
Oh yes,
the Antique Show, and of course, because they were not in Salisbury, they held it in the town hall.
Oh, and that was wonderful.
Space in the town
that
hall.
That was wonderful.
And That basically became the Fall Festival.
Yes, it started in about 1958. Mm-hmm. I did a tidbit on that one. So that's about 1958. And it was an absolutely wonderful. I came in 67 and they were still having the antiques in the town hall until the town hall burned in 85 and then it sort of went down.
Trinity, I think by that time had pretty well been aged out.
I think at that point they didn't have a place for the antiques, and so they either melded with other locations or went in a different direction.
Yeah, my sense is that Trinity was never a large congregation, and if you don't have the right ration of old ladies,
yes, I know,
willing to do this sort of thing,
we're running out of little old ladies. I know,
we're running out too. But since then. You know, actually, there are a number of things. How am I doing?
You're doing fine. Never know. I'm just checking that it's still recording.
Oh, okay. It's funny. I came to Trinity, the parish church that I had been previously involved with was New York City, and it was St. James Madison Avenue, and they were a very wealthy parish, and they did an awful lot in the community. They gave away literally millions a year. And I sat on one of the committees that used to go out and interview beneficiaries, which were large, things like, well, we want to start a birthing center on 94th Street or something like that, or we want to build a this or that, or we want to hire 50 people from, you were talking good size money. And one of the things that I liked about Trinity as soon as I got there was the fact that they were thinking outside the building, outside the four walls. Yeah. And that, I think, pretty well continued. The things outside that I started.
I'm trying to get you into Crescendo. That's where I'm
going. Oh, well, Crescendo. Oh, yeah, sure. That was Christine. I mean, that's, God, we...
Yeah, but it...
And the story of how... Did she tell you of how she got hooked up with Trinity?
She did in her interview, but if you'd like to refresh my memory.
Oh my God, that was amazing. Well, we had the organist who for a variety of reasons left Beth alone, who was the rector then, without an organist. And Trinity has always liked its music ever since. Well, the first organ was bought by the women who had church suppers and sold pot pies for 25 cents, chicken pot pies, and thus paid for the first organ.
When did that come in?
Oh, that very early on. It shows up in the earliest, it was probably there before 1880.
Before 1880?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I could probably research that because I do have the opus number from that old organ, and that probably is traceable. But it's been there in the 1900-1905 period.
Okay, it is early then.
They already had it. It was in place. They actually had a boys' choir.
Mm-hmm.
Or a choir of men and boys, as they say in the Episcopal Church, which you don't expect to see in a, you expect that St. Thomas is in New York or something like that. You don't expect that.
But they like music. So
yeah, they did. And it's always been a pretty musical congregation.
Okay, so getting back to Christine.
Well, Beth was without an organist, and she happened to be at a lunch at a... New wave, edgy, very edgy guru in Lee, Mass. And the name escapes me, but...
They weren't the Hare Krishna, were they?
No, they weren't Hare Krishna, but I think he has since been ridden out of town in a rage.
Yeah, but I know who you mean.
Yeah, but anyway, Beth was there having lunch and doing whatever they do. Mm-hmm. And... she was seated next to Christine, and she said something like, "Gee, I really need an organist. Does anybody know an organist?" And Christine said, "Well, I play the organ." And Christine in that organization had been stuck in the mailroom.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, and I think Beth hired her on the spot without hearing her touch a keyboard. And as a matter of fact, not too long after that, because I had a truck, I was volunteered to go up and transport Christine's harpsichord to Lime Rock.
And I do hope you were careful with it.
Well, I was very careful with it, and the interesting thing was that the guru himself came out and was making disapproving sounds as we loaded and drove off with a harpsichord, and she assured him that she'd be back soon.
Yes.
This was only temporary.
Yes, yes. And at least 10 years later, she still is.
Yeah, she's and Crescendo, I think, was basically an early effort to keep her busy.
Oh yeah, it was.
I mean, it was. She thought it would be fun to do this.
And she's done a marvelous job with it.
And she certainly has. I don't know. It's incredible. I wasn't in Crescendo initially, but then I did join and sang for several years. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, I think my voice was actually making a net contribution. But after about 5 years, it became evident to me that instead of benefiting the tenor section, I was a little bit of a drag on the tenor section.
You couldn't possibly have been.
I think I was. It got that good. And it just has gotten better. And at that point...
Yes, it has.
At that point, I resigned from active singing and went on the board. And have...
She's done a marvelous job with
it. Oh, yeah.
She came... About 2000, and I started taking lessons from her after Denise Restoux died.
Uh-huh, sure.
So I probably was taking lessons from her 2003.
Okay, that's early. That's
yes.
Definitely early
yes.
on. Yeah.
It was early on. It was before Crescendo.
Yeah.
Do you remember when Lucy Cooney had the children's
camp? I remember that. My daughter went to it.
Oh, she did?
Yes, she had the children's camp. I think I don't know if the children's school was there too, but she definitely had the camp. And I remember my wife being highly incensed that the children had evidently been instructed one day on how babies were made.
That would be Lucy Cooney.
And... Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's all of the good. And my wife said,
yeah, well.
But
that would be Lucy Cooney.
Yeah, that's, I never met Lucy, but I.
Oh, I had her son.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Before she started the children's school, I had her son in my fourth grade.
Oh, wow.
I've got a knowledge of various parents and children because of teaching.
Oh, sure.
Which, you know, adds to the flavor.
Absolutely.
Adds
now,
to the
it's,
flavor.
Well, it's funny. Actually, I let something go that I wanted to run with, and I don't remember what it was. Maybe I'll think of it later. But, involving the Trinity being, it goes all the way back to when we were talking about it, whether it was for basically the upper echelon or for the whole community. And Mrs. Barnum very clearly stated that the church was to be for the whole community. And she acted on this.
Good.
She and Mrs. Richardson mm-hmm. were godmothers for any number of children whose mother had been married two months earlier in the rectory.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. And when no one else obviously was going to do it. And
did she start a Sunday school?
Well, there's a Sunday school. There's a banner from the Trinity Lime Rock Sunday School dated 1887 that still hangs in Walker Hall when there isn't an art show up.
Oh, my word.
So,
yeah, she probably did get...
I think she did.
She was organized.
She was a heavy hitter. But it did. As a matter of fact, I said about 5 years ago, and I think this is accurate, that the greatest social error you can make at Trinity... is to be snotty, be socially, you know, you can be unpleasant individuals,
yeah.
but you can't be unpleasant.
You can't put on airs.
You cannot put on airs. If you put on airs, if you put on airs quietly, you can simply be viewed as eccentric.
Mm-hmm.
If you put on airs loudly, you'll be
you're a persona non grata.
Yeah, you'll be actively vilified. But so that's one of the effects. And periodically somebody will say something about, oh well, we only have a very high form of the service, and we must be very high church. And someone else will say,
why?
Yeah. We don't need to do that. We can do it some of the time.
Yeah. My mother was brought up Episcopalian, and it was low church.
Mm-hmm.
And then she married my father, who was Methodist Episcopal.
Uh-huh. Oh, sure.
So, you know, it's whatever works.
Yeah,
it's whatever
exactly.
works.
Well, that's the thing. But we did, oh, God, I know that very early on we had just, when I arrived at Trinity, we had just taken a refugee family from somewhere behind the Iron Curtain, who had fled with his family and had needed a place to live, and they were being taken care of in the parish. I remember, about 12 years ago, and this reflected more and more of this outward looking attitude, and I think probably it's this sort of thing that probably helped Trinity more than anything else. I was talking for some reason to a 9-year-old girl in the parish, where she came up to me in coffee hour,
mm-hmm.
and she said, "Mr. Brown, what are the children supposed to do in the summer when there's no Sunday school?" So I said, my best pedagogical manner says, "Well, Courtney, what do you think?
Oh, good man.
See, now wasn't that good? And Courtney said,
"It's called passing the buck."
Courtney said, "We could play soccer."
Uh-huh.
And I said,
"Yes,
you could." So we started, Courtney and I.
Yeah.
I will tell you, Beth Long was, I knew she would hate the idea. So, in a huge political roundabout, I rounded up all the votes on the vestry to go along with it, and then broached the topic at a vestry meeting, and watched Beth anxiously look around for somebody who was going to agree with her if she vetoed it.
And nobody would. Oh.
And the next Sunday, we were out there
playing soccer.
There were only a handful of us, but we were out there kicking a soccer ball around. And it got to the point where at one point, we had one Sunday when we had more than 70 kids, 7-0.
Wonderful.
Out there in that field, which, by the way, was a stroke of genius on the part of Bob Reed, which I'll get back to. But we had more than 70 kids in the field, and we had a couple of volunteer coaches from Hotchkiss,
mm-hmm.
who came down and helped coach, and it was pretty good. It was pretty good soccer. The field was a little rough, but
that's all right.
We began, and then somebody asked me to, since Salisbury didn't have a representative on what was the name of the soccer club, the travel soccer team here? It's Northwest United. It's now Northwest United Soccer Club, previous Berkshire United Soccer Club. It was the travel soccer team that played soccer around,
okay.
you know, in the state around. It was organized youth soccer.
Okay.
As opposed to school soccer. And I went on the board for a couple of years, unofficially, and we actually were considering offering the field as their home field, but it clearly needed about $10,000 worth of
improvement
before it was going to be good for that. And then the guy who was pushing it retired from Salisbury School, and gradually that whole idea slipped away, and
okay.
we stopped our financial support of the of travel soccer.
Travel soccer.
Shortly after that.
All right.
And gradually, 70 was, I think, the high point in terms of number of kids. After that, it began to
decline a bit.
Yeah.
Is there anything else before we close that you want to add about the church, Sunday school, the vestry, the choir, or have we covered
the
main points?
Well, actually, something is happening right now which I think is really good. Oh, let me do one thing. We had been looking, it seemed to us that the soccer thing was successful, and various other things we had been sort of doing out in the community were successful. And then Bishop Smith came to talk to the vestry. He came for a visitation just before he retired, and I wish I could put a year on this. It was only a few years ago, maybe 5 to 7 or 8 years ago. And we were, at that point, pretty healthy shape. And he said basically, it was about 7 years ago. We were at a point where we were financially, we had built an addition, paid for the addition, mm-hmm. had no debt, had a decent sized congregation every Sunday in Tucson, and Crescendo was strong. The art show was only one art show at that point. Now there are something like five mm-hmm. each year. But he said, you know, you really got to get out of the church. You know, this is not all just about what you do for an hour on Sunday morning. This is what you do all the time in the community. This is, you know, and gave us 5 or 10 biblical examples of why this had to be the way. And we did, and we started very actively forming and seeking collaborations with outside organizations. And don't really care whether they're religious or even not-for-profit. Mm-hmm. And I could begin to list the collaborations that we have right now, but they range from such relatively minor things as making a small financial donation to really being quite involved, as we are with Salisbury Winter Sports Association.
We'll get to that in another interview.
Okay. The arts community, and that's something that's pretty good too, is now the art shows are put on by essentially outsiders with one or two Trinity people on the committee.
Are they juried shows?
Well, all the new ones all are. Marianne Carley, who is from Sharon, I think, mm-hmm. has basically started with the juried shows.
Yeah.
She's had a number of them. One we partnered with SWASA on, mm-hmm. and we'll two as a matter of fact, and we'll continue again this coming year. We have one coming up, a photographic show.
Good.
That she said she knows absolutely nothing about and doesn't want to run. And I don't know anything about running art shows. And Heidi will be on sabbatical at that point.
Oh, that's going to be fun.
So it'll be entirely run by outsiders mm-hmm. in the Trinity space. And that's fine.
Sure.
We're perfectly happy with that. There's so much. Somebody 3 or 4 years ago breathed in the ear of one of the kids something about some of the children at North Canaan going back to school without any school supplies or backpack. Mm-hmm. And two of the girls grasped the idea of a backpack project. And they really took it and ran with it and rounded up 20-odd backpacks. And the following year got more kids involved.
Good.
And made videos, very imaginative videos. Mm-hmm. I shot them. They did them. I just pointed the camera.
Yeah.
based on a Harry Potter theme and running around, yes. running around Trinity and you know, waving magic wands and having lights come on and everything.
Oh, lovely!
Else. And the kids really drove that one, and yep. they got a really nice turnout in terms of backpacks. And then, unfortunately, some of the adults decided that they wanted to tell the kids how they could do it better. So, of course, the kids immediately dropped it.
Yeah.
And at that point, some of the women who were being lay preachers at the Methodist campground in mm-hmm. Falls Village,
mm-hmm. Pine Grove.
Pine Grove, that's it. Got them involved. So basically, we did the drive last year was a collaboration with Pine Grove.
Good.
And we'll play with anybody. I think if you
present a good idea and you'll go with it.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we.
How wonderful.
You know, and we. I don't know. We're. I like to think that we're as ecumenical as anybody can be. I know that an awful lot of Christmas pageants at St. Mary's go on in Trinity costumes.
Whatever
for
works.
Example.
I thank you so much for your information and your time.
I've blown past an hour. Well.